beautiful summer weather Saturday night, which is really important for our discussion today. Clear skies, lows will be in the mid-50s. This concert, the final summer concert of the summer by the Kalamazoo Symphony, is outdoors. It will be presented at the Gilmore Carr Museum. And in fact, this is not the first time this summer that's happened. You've had a number of successful outdoor concerts. The luck has held, and it looks like it's going to hold for this incredible summer closer. I'm so excited to hear about this. Julian Cuerta, you programmed this in an interesting way. In fact, you were inspired by a program that was performed by the KSO how many years ago?
Yes, it's quite remarkable. So as you know, at the Kalamazoo Symphony, we're celebrating our 100th anniversary. And as part of our celebrations, doing my research, I began to dig deep into the history of the KSO and to look at what some of the previous music directors had programmed and some of the great programs of our history. And I came across this particular program, which was first performed exactly as we will do it on Saturday in 1962 by Gregory Millar. And, you know, as a conductor, programming Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, it's always a wonderful puzzle. It's a very uncomfortable length. It's hard to pair it with other works. You have a chorus available that you would love to use, but they only sing in the last movement of the Beethoven, so there's room for them to do something else. And then on the other side of it, it's what part of the Beethoven do you want to illustrate with the music you choose on the first part of the program? Do you want to have something that fits spiritually, or do you want to have something very contrasting? And so I've sort of collected these Beethoven 9 programs that I've loved over the years, either, you know, by attending concerts or reading about them. And this program really stuck out for me as being an incredibly creative way of programming this particular piece. And I just thought it was so remarkable that as a tribute to our 100 years, I wanted to recreate this concert and to do it again, to show where we were and also how far we'd come.
Julian, you have a lot to juggle as the new music director of the Kalamazoo Symphony, just a few seasons now. You're celebrating 100 years with a symphony that you're fairly new to. I can't tell you how much it means that you became an historian to celebrate this little band that started way back when, 100 years ago, and just made it about our memories and our love of this amazing group.
And, you know, the one thing that I learned very quickly working here is that the symphony touches so many people, and it's so much a part of our community, and people have such deep and loving memories of what we do here and who we are. So I really enjoyed the research and looking at our past, because I think that's the only way we're going to get to our future is by knowing where we've come from.
In a bigger context, we've been living through a pandemic, and science has kind of got us out of it. If we can modify our behaviors in order to save ourselves, as it were. And in a similar way, music, just like science, kind of builds on itself. If it refers back all the time to work others did before, just like science. And this particular work is so symbolic. And to me, I'm putting all kinds of symbolism into the fact that this is being performed now. And the symphony has done everything possible to stay connected through a pandemic year where you couldn't have audiences. Now you can. Now it's still, we have this murkiness happening again, but it's the ninth. It's Beethoven's ninth. It requires a huge effort, and you're doing it.
And we are so happy to be able to do it and to work with singers for the first time since we were shut down. Our very last performance in March indoors was a major vocal work by Mahler. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we since that time, we have not had the opportunity to work with the voice. And the human voice is so important to the genesis of music, and I love vocal music. I am so passionate about it, and it's been a real difficult period for me not to be able to program works like this. And, you know, just as something that you said that just kind of struck me about science now being the way out of this pandemic, you know, in Schiller's Ode, this embodiment of Enlightenment philosophy and this idea that science and philosophy and art will pave the way for a new mankind, a new birth, you know, post-French Revolution. I think there's so many similarities, and the message of this music is extremely powerful right now, where it's about the future, it's about optimism, it's about being together, about helping your fellow man. There's so much in this music and in the poetry that really applies to us today. Hmm.
I want to remind listeners that KalamazooSymphony.com is where to find tickets for Saturday night's performance. You will be able to enjoy the program from either the lawn at the Gilmore Carr Museum. That means bringing blankets and chairs, and I would be bringing a special little flask myself, and there's also some seats available still, although they're nearly gone. So KalamazooSymphony.com is where to go. You'll find details on this concert, and on August 24th, the announcement for the next season. Is it 101?
We're going to stretch 100 a little bit. Yeah. We didn't really get a fair shot at celebrating our 100th anniversary. And if you look in the history books, the very first concert of the Kalamazoo Symphony was in December 1921. So I figure we're still within our bounds of calling this sort of our 100th plus season.
Now, seated here with me are three of the four soloists in the Ode to Joy, Beethoven's Ninth. Each of them has their own personal challenge to fulfill for this concert. It's physically demanding, and you have to use your ears, and Beethoven did not make it easy. And we're going to talk to each of the soloists this hour. I really feel like hearing some music from the symphony to begin, though, and perhaps this wonderful Out of the Depths opening. And Julian, you can tell us a little about what it sounds like. Why?
Of the first movement.
Yeah, the very first movement.
It's like a Genesis story. We're about to embark on an incredible voyage, and this is sort of the primordial soup. Totally undefined. He doesn't tell us what key we're in, nothing. It's just an open fifth and suddenly trickling in the signs of life until it erupts in this unbelievable force that carries you basically from that first movement all the way to the fourth movement.
Here's the opening of Beethoven's Ninth. Get ready for a performance Saturday. It begins at 8 o'clock in the evening on a beautiful Saturday night at the Gilmore Carr Museum. Tickets available at KalamazooSymphony.com.
Thank you.
We are leaving you hanging in the opening movement of Beethoven's Choral Symphony, the Ode to Joy, the Symphony No. 9, and it is all on stage this Saturday at 8 o'clock. In the studio with me, if you've just joined us, is Maestro Julian Quercy. We have three of the four soloists, vocal soloists, that is, as well, and we have a chance to get to know them and their approach to this wonderful, wonderful work, which I just framed as a necessary act of hope in a season that has been so disrupted, and for artists who haven't had the chance to do what they do best and feel that connection with audiences. You can feel that connection at 8 o'clock Saturday at the Gilmore Carr Museum. There's an incredible stage set up to bring you this music over the fields and experience it in a way that you want to. So now it's time to talk to the soloists. And I'll, first of all, open question. Is anybody here singing this for the first time? That's a no. Everybody yeah. has performed Beethoven.
No excuses then. No excuses. Yeah.
I didn't expect anyone to say, "Yep, it's my first time," because it's an essential piece. Although it's so hard to bring enough resources together to put it on that it's not an everyday piece. I'll start with you, Ben Gully. You are singing tenor for this performance. I'm really glad to meet you for the first time because your ties to Kalamazoo have grown exponentially in the last few years. Your wife is executive director of the Kalamazoo Symphony, Jessica Mello Gully. And I guess the two of you represent a very musical couple. You have a long background as a tenor, although you've diversified that singing, that technique, to many different things. Would you tell us a little about your early days as a singer and how you ended up, carving your own path?
Sure, sure. All roads lead to the Beethoven 9, right? Is that what we is what we're learning today? I'm a Midwestern boy. I grew up singing kind of sacred music in the church and grew up singing gospel. And then it's kind of fortuitous. Scott happens to be one of the best bassists in the world, but I met him when we were 18 years old, Scott and I met. And he jokes he gets 10% of my career because he's the one listening to UC Bierling in his Silverado blaring with windows down is what I sang bass in choir with this guy. So knowing that one day I'd get to sing high notes around the world in foreign languages, I kind of giggled. We always dreamed, but we never knew that it would be that. So Sky was actually pretty formulative in what got me to be singing and in the studio today. But I'm a trite fellow, as you all know. I kind of think it's all the same 12 notes, whether it's Beethoven to Daft Punk. It's we're all using the same little magic spells to create these moments of heightened existence. So to me, it was always this pursuit. Once I found opera, I had to climb that ladder. And it's been my goal ever since to get... if there is a top of our musical ladders? I always think that, a lot of artists, we're always kind of chasing this unending journey. But yeah, so I'm still climbing the ladder, but it's all the same 12 notes to me.
Tell me about some moments when you fulfilled a dream in your musical career.
Oh, that's actually Scott and I, to go back to Scott, it was a few years ago. And I get to say this, the night my wife and I started talking romantically was a couple nights I had made my Carnegie Hall debut and he had made his Met debut within 3 nights right of each other. So we were both giggling at this. And then I start talking to my now wife that day. So that's one of the big moments. Scott and I joke, when you're a young 18-year-old listening to these recordings and seeing the advent of YouTube, we could watch our heroes on the stage, and we'd have these little dreams of like, I can't wait to stand center stage right there. And then Scott and I, about 5-6 years ago, started going, oh, it's time to dream new dreams. We're here now. We're doing some of the things we dreamt about. So that's maybe my favorite thing is maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I had to start dreaming new dreams and putting new, I want to debut here. I want to go do here. I want to sing this. I want to. So that's maybe my favorite aspect of the career right now. Yeah.
I have to bring Scott into this because clearly there's almost a back and forth happening already. Scott Connor, I should
yes,
say.
Hi.
Just listen to that voice. Oh, my goodness.
I tell him he has to speak at least an octave higher in the morning. So
oh, wow.
Okay, I read that you're from Kansas.
I am, yeah. Born and raised in Kansas City, Kansas.
Oh, wonderful.
You know, my parents were not musical. They were both in aviation, you know, so I don't know where the musical gene came from, but I grew up, you know, loving all sorts of music and started singing in choir when I was in middle school, and my teacher heard something there, so I started taking voice lessons and piano lessons and fell in love with it. So we ended up going to college together where I met Ben and started living together, and I feel like we fed off of each other. You know, he would listen to the tenor repertoire. We were, you know, introducing each other to this new genre of different musical styles. And so our musical abilities grew through the conservatory and then on into our careers. And, you know, even, you know, he says, well, he used to sing bass and you know, I also have this idea where when I access my top notes, I access them sometimes like a tenor. And it's interesting because we exchange ideas on techniques and
you trade off on clefs as well.
Exactly. You know, we have a good time and, you know, we've learned a lot from each other and what to do, what not to do. So I feel like I'm very lucky to have this opportunity to come back and sing with my best friend.
Goodness gracious. You know? Roommates, you could have been devouring Netflix series, but you were actually listening to different recordings.
Yep.
Learning
about
it.
We were all the time.
That's really
Melody,
terrific.
You would have totally been invited to come listen to music with us, too. Yeah, you would have totally been.
Scott, would you name a highlight of your musical passion?
Yeah, you know what? He actually said it. My Met debut was pretty amazing. I did a new Robert Carson production of Der Rosenkavalier that we had premiered at Covent Garden in London, and then I took it to the Met. And that happened to be with Rene Fleming and Elena Garancha.
It was her farewell performance, right?
It was her farewell performance.
I saw that in the movie theater.
Yes, and I played the police commissioner in that. And Robert Carson, who I love dearly, staged the end of the opera where the police commissioner, which was the role I was singing, left the stage with the marshal and Rene Fleming. And I got to walk Renee out on her final exit. It was
weepy best friend moment.
Yeah, really, really. And she's such a special artist and an individual. And so I consider that to be one of the highlights of my career. Yeah.
Let's talk to Melody Wilson. You sing mezzo-soprano. A lot of singers have an interesting journey to finding their range, if I know what I'm talking about. And perhaps you could tell us a little about finding your mezzo voice.
Well, it's really interesting. In undergrad, I was told I was a contralto, actually. I didn't have any high notes. My highest note was an E on the staff. And I was singing, I sounded more like a tenor, I think. And then it just started stretching my range. And luckily, when I went to U of M, and I got to work with Shirley Verrett. You were talking about highlights, but certainly that is a very memorable highlight and a very important part of my life, mm-hmm. just spending years and working with her and knowing that she was just sort of taking me under her wing and grooming me to sing her repertoire. And I discovered that I was a young dramatic mezzo. So, and she stretched me up, and now I can sing Queen of the Night notes. So it's kind of... From tenor to Queen of the Night.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's the name of your album, right?
Yeah. Right. Was her job to make you comfortable and not frustrated with the training, the physicality of extending your range? Mm. It's hard to keep at things that you can't immediately do sometimes.
That's very true, and I'm a little bit OCD, so it was definitely very frustrating for me, but she was very patient, and she always told me, hurry slowly.
Mm-hmm.
That was her thing that she said to me all the time, and she would also say, darling, don't flagellate yourself.
Oh, I love that. Don't flagellate.
I'm going to use that today. Yes. Melody, I love that there's a Michigan connection over in Ann Arbor. Where did you grow up?
In Maryland and Delaware.
I'm a Delawarean
on paper, so. First state, woohoo.
And we've met one.
So, and opera has been your career.
It has. You know, I've had a really interesting journey. I wanted to be a UN translator.
What language?
Oh, and several. I mean, oh, I have a, actually, I live in Vienna, Austria, where the UN is, and I have a lot of friends that work at the UN, so I feel like I'm sort of part of it, even though I'm not. But, you know, you're required to speak, I think, 5 languages there or something like that. And
the service lost an amazing possibility here.
But, yeah, I was a clarinetist and more into that. I was in school. I was the drum major. And also the color guard captain. Tell me how that happened. And also a cheerleader for all sports. So I've just sort of been all over. And I decided at some point to put the clarinet down and the bass clarinet too and to focus more on singing. And I was surprised that when it came time for grad school that I was able to go to one of the best institutions. And I'm very thankful for that.
That's crazy. You tried so many things, and I give all opera singers a pass on having hobbies and other, you know, other parts of.
We're real people. We are. We are. Yeah.
Because I think of it as so demanding. In an opera company, when you're part of the cast, mm-hmm. if that's the word. How do you feel? Overly responsible to do a good job, or does just meeting and practicing kind of give you a more relaxed attitude that it's going to go fine no matter what?
I think there's a balance in both of those things. Certainly when you come in with the right foundation, the right technique, you're confident in knowing that that technique will guide you through no matter what, even if you're not feeling well one day, you know, because you're not going to feel 100% on every performance. I think throughout 365 days a year, I might say on 5 days of that whole year that I really sang yeah. well today. Yeah. I'm really picky. Yeah. So on the other hand, you just go and try to experience the music, deliver the text, really be a good colleague, and have fun together, you know? That's
That reminds me of the Gene Kelly had that saying of a dance saying of practiced and loose. Everyone would always ask him, like, Gene, how do you make it look? How do you make that one maneuver look so easy? He goes, you didn't see me practice it 7,000 times.
Yeah.
So that by the 7,001st time, it looked like I just made the move up. Mm-hmm. And so that's the trick of high arts. A lot of the time we have to interpret something so critical and technical that we have amazing ears of our maestros. We're going for 100%. Those 5 days is what we're singing for, like what Melody just said. So when the moment you don't get one right, you know, that's the scorecard we're all at. So practice so that you can be loose, mm-hmm. so that the stress of achieving this high art doesn't cripple you. You don't buckle underneath it. That's my 2 cents, yeah.
Well, you just mentioned the ears of the maestro, and I find that a really difficult challenge, that when you're practicing, you can't necessarily trust what you're hearing right. coming from your own voice. Exactly. That makes no sense to me. Like, that's the only ears you have. And it takes another level to say, I trust the ears not in my head, but out there. Can you practice for that? Or do you have to kind of wait and see what the maestro has to say?
You have to be together with the people that you're singing with, because as soon as you add two instruments, as soon as you add them to space, to the air, the molecules change. They move differently.
Preach.
And whatever you practice on your own, it's going to change as soon as you add 2, 3, 4 voices in the case of this Beethoven. So it's really, I love the initial phases of putting together this solo quartet, because everybody is trying to find and see where they fit in and how their voice reflects and supports their colleagues. And it's really, it's amazing. You know, instinct is firing on such a high level. And the technique, I think, if I can speak for all of the singers here, the technique is something that you just rely on, but it's a much more physical and almost animal type connection that we have to try to develop, because the technique is just going to be the same, but it's the chemistry. We're talking about building chemistry, musical and personal, on stage. And I love this aspect of it. And with this piece, we'll meet and we'll sing it, and it'll be over and done with. But if you have the chance to work with a cast of an opera over a 2-3 week period, it's like this on steroids. You really have this, and you have a lot of peaks and valleys, and those valleys are important. We always try to avoid them, but I think that we need them. In order to get something to be as good as it can be, you need to break it a little bit. I mean, sometimes we don't dare to break things when we're getting this close to a performance. I would never try to do that. By the way, just so you know.
Noted.
But if you're working on something that you really want to have that inspirational, emotional, dramatical effect, you need to test all the boundaries. You need to push it beyond the point where it's comfortable, so that you can get back to basically what Ben was saying. This trained looseness, that it feels like you're creating it on the spot, when in fact you've really done everything you can to make sure that you're walking that very fine line.
This is all on the minds of my guests this morning, the maestro Julian Quercy of the Kalamazoo Symphony, Ben Gully, tenor, Scott Connor, bass, and mezzo-soprano Melody Wilson. The soprano soloist is on her way here today. Her name is Caitlin
Lynch.
And she will join you for rehearsal tonight, tomorrow, and the concert is Saturday. Tickets are available at kalamazoosymphony.com. I'm addicted to hearing about what's going on in your minds as you prepare and become the vessel for a performance like this. And it, at the same time, it doesn't necessarily matter. What matters is the music that happens on Saturday night, and it will be spectacular. It's so significant, symbolic, the Kalamazoo Symphony celebrating 100 years in a very difficult, under difficult circumstances. It is a moment to celebrate at 8 o'clock. We also have a chance to talk about the other works on the program, but I want to dive back into the Symphony No. 9 and hear some choral music. We haven't mentioned that there's a big chorus involved here. Who's helped prepare that?
Well, we spent a lot of time at the symphony trying to figure out how to mount this production, especially in COVID. And at this time of the year in August, so many of the regular choruses that we work with were not in session. Mm-hmm. So we ended up having to build our own. And I like to think of it as a chorus that probably would have been roughly the same size that Beethoven might have had, you know, at his first performance, because it's not very big, but we have handpicked those singers to sing with us, and they're all people who have had a lot of experience singing in choir and are able to produce enough tone. It's going to be a chamber choir, but they're not going to sound like it. Mm-hmm. And I worked with them for the first time on Monday. I had a chance to hear them, and they sound great. It's going to be a big, big performance for the orchestra and for the community. And this choir that we've put together, I'm really proud of them. I think they're going to do great.
This is live radio here on Classical WMUK 89.9, and I'm just going to slide the CD cover over to Julian and have him pick a segment for us to, sample some of both the chorus, some of the solo parts. I know that the tenor, Ben, you have a pretty massive part about friendship.
In the scheme of this piece, yeah, for sure. Yeah, that little arietta, yeah. Yeah, you get to bring the joy and kind of march in like the hero, like the knight on his horse going to victory, as the lyrics say. So, It's a good part, yeah. It's kind of iconic, so it always feels great to get to sing it.
Okay, Julian Cuarti, where shall we begin?
We will begin in the fourth movement. Beethoven takes this, it's called a Schreckenfanfare. It's like a frightening, painful fanfare, a disgusting, grotesque eruption from the orchestra. And we hear this a number of times in the introduction, but this time he says enough, and it's the bass first to say, friends, not like this, please.
Yes.
let's relax a little bit and let's focus on joy. And then we hear the very famous Ode to Joy melody for the first time, and it builds and it builds and it builds, and then we will hear then some of the soloists singing and the chorus singing. But I'll ask you probably to cut it off before we get to the thing that everybody's waiting for, because you have to come to the concert
That's
to hear
right.
that.
Scott, I stole your thunder. I gave Ben the credit for that opening statement, but it's you.
Yeah, you know, and I feel this is so appropriate, this piece, for coming out of COVID. You know, we just had the conversation last night, how fortunate I feel to be back, to be singing, but also be able to bring music and joy to the world again. And this is so important. And I feel like I've had so many people and other concerts and things that I've done recently, and the crowds have come up to me and said, I missed this so much. I need this in my life. And I forgot how badly, you know, we adore this music. And so to come out and sing Freude, joy, and spread this message after such a hard year and a half has really the perfect way to come back. So I feel like this is so important. And I told him yesterday, I said, you know, we get to come back and do this and not let our nerves get in the way anymore, because it is what we do for a living, to bring joy, to bring music at a time when the public, the world needs this.
This message matters more than ever. Yeah, overly trite, but these words are really powerful. Depending on no matter what decade or era you come from, they really are incredible. Mm-hmm. And I think all of us can probably say that the joy of this is what the miraculous part that we really do need. And the message of this is together. Mm-hmm. We don't do this as soloists. We don't do it as individuals. We're doing the entire symphony, the entire chorus, and the audience is part of the show too. A lot of audience doesn't get that, so you know, it's medicine in the desert. Yeah,
I am going to be there because I saw it months ago on the program, and I thought, this is the thing I deserve for having suffered and denied myself for a year and a half. This is the piece that will give me the release that may bookend a difficult time. I've been very lucky through this, but at the same time, we all deserve this, and we're going to have it Saturday night. As as I expected, turning on Beethoven's Ninth Symphony in the studio with three vocal soloists and a conductor turned into an amazing party and singing along and total enthusiasm for this music. They're totally unprofessional at the moment. You know, it's just all about how great Beethoven is. And I have a really tiny, mild question for Melody Wilson, who just mentioned, you know, her home is Vienna, Austria. I'd like to know what you love about going home and what you look forward to when you get off that plane. And if you can add any description of how German-speaking people feel about this work. I know there's a sense of ownership there, but it is a universal piece.
It is. And, well, first of all, Vienna is fantastic, and I can't wait to get home. And, of course, it's always great to come home, too. I love my country, and I miss it.
Is it the pastries, the coffee?
I'm a savory person, but Vienna has convinced me that I should move to the sweet side.
Is it the history, the buildings?
It's the architecture. Yeah. It's the cleanliness. It's just so pristine. And the passion for organized and passion for classical music, really. You know,
you don't have to go out and explain yourself all the time.
No, and people really love it. They appreciate it so much. At the Staatsoper, they play operas for free outdoors. They project them on the side of the building, and anyone can come out and sit. And what I thought was just so cute, which I haven't seen in the U.S. It could happen, but it's just so Viennese. There were these teenagers, and they were on a date, and they were just holding hands and sitting and watching the opera on the side of the building. And they look like they were like 16 years old. I can't imagine 16-year-olds here in the States doing that.
Right. Well, but if you projected it on the side of buildings, they might. Yeah.
Yeah, the appreciation is there. You know, people grow up listening to this music in their homes with their grandmother or their parents. And it's an important part of the structure there, the infrastructure. So
it is. A lot of exposure.
It just reminds me that, you know, here they tend to play classical music in outdoor places where they don't want teenagers together.
Right. Yeah.
I never understood that. I mean, really.
But to speak of Vienna, this is where this piece debuted, right? This is where the ninth debuted in Vienna. Is that right?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, all comes back to Vienna. All roads lead to Beethoven.
Beethoven ended his career in Vienna, and of course, there's the stories of his funeral are incredible. The processions that went on, and
it was enormous. He had one of the largest funerals, and the pallbearers, you know, people like Schubert. He was carrying a torch, and anybody who was involved in music was there. It was about 20,000 people. It's enormous. Wow. And his tomb in Vienna, I'm sure you've been to visit. It's ornate. It's enormous. It's very prominent. They really adore their local or adopted son, because he was born in Germany. He was he was from Bonn, where he began his infatuation with the Enlightenment philosophy and with Schiller's Ode. He started to begin working on this when he was a teenager, and it took him a whole lifetime to really put the tools together to be able to write what he did.
We're here in Kalamazoo, we're here in Michigan, and we don't get to see or hear Beethoven's Ninth every day. It's always a couple years in between at least, and you have to travel around to find it. This is your chance to enjoy a meaningful performance in a beautiful setting. We haven't really talked about how gorgeous the Gilmore Carr Museum
is.
It's
beautiful, idyllic out there. Yeah. And, you know, there's this passage towards the end of the fourth movement where Schiller writes, über Sternen muss wohnen, such ihn über Sternen zelt. He must live beyond the stars. Look for him past the starry canopy, and we're gonna have stars. We're gonna be performing that. The audience, you can sit there in your chair. You can gaze at the heavens. You can see what small, minuscule part we play on this tiny little planet in this amazing universe. And this is what this piece is all about. It's about our place and the gift of art and the gift of humanity, and that field there at the Carr Museum, so peaceful, tranquil. It's going to be phenomenal.
Brotherhood.
In 1962, the Kalamazoo Symphony Orchestra started a program with the Fanfare for the Common Man by Aaron Copland and continued with the Godunov, or is that the...
Yes.
Second piece, a section from Boris Godunov by Modest Mussorgsky, which features four soloists. One
soloist plus a little cameo.
And finished with Symphony No. 9. And because of Julian Quercetti's flipping through old programs and getting a sense of this orchestra, we are able to hear it recreated again on Saturday. I would like to play a little bit of the Godunov because Mussorgsky is just really cool. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's just the cool guy who did his own thing and so worth hearing. And that's about all we have time for. A final thought just from you, Julian. I would like to thank Ben Gulley, Scott Connor, and Melody Wilson for coming here. We could go on for another hour, but this is where we have to wrap it up. Julian, final thoughts.
I have just been given a gift to be able to perform for audiences this summer with the symphony. And this final concert of our summer celebration, it's going to be spectacular. It's been so popular. People have just been in love with what we're doing out there at the Carr Museum. I really, really look forward to seeing everybody out there. And please make time if you can be there. It will be very, very much rewarded. It's going to be a great event.
And like I said before, we all deserve this. KalamazooSymphony.com for tickets. A little bit of Godunov next.